Welcome to another Podcast on Fire Network bonus episode on the movie In Harm's Way. So if you're going to support writers and directors, you go all the way if you're doing a podcast coverage in our case. And as I was researching the last episode of our Mabel Chung and Alex Law director series, I found a movie listing next to her name from 2017. And again, her last directed film to date is A Tale of Three Cities, 2015. Specifically, this 2017 entry was for the Chinese war drama In Harm's Way, aka The Chinese Widow, aka The Hidden Soldier, which was directed by Danish filmmaker Bille August, who did Pelle the Conqueror, and starring Emil Hirsch and Liu Yifei, the star of Mulan. And Mabel was online credited with co-writing the screenplay with Greg Latter, but she's only listed on Wikipedia and not IMDb. And looking at the movie, she's not listed as co-writer, and I couldn't spot any other credit for like Mandarin dialogue writer, consultant, etc. So who knows? The wiki might be lying. The internet might be lying. In Europe.
But the first time.
Why would we have an error on Mabel Chung's page? It's not like people are going in there like, oh, we're going to fuck up her career now. We're going to add stuff.
Bit too specific.
So yeah, we're here. We bought the DVD and we can't watch it in solitude and not make notes about it. So let's put it to work. So this is connected to the Mabel Chung coverage, but she, in all likelihood, had nothing to do with In Harm's Way. So here we are. I'm Kenny B, and with me is still Tom KW.
Still here, loving life with my good pal Kenny, discussing movies. Good times, man. Good times.
So this will be like a big finale package, because I've placed matters so that we can put up the finale on A Tale of Three Cities that she did, the bonus episode on Moon Warriors that her and Alex worked on and directed scenes in, and we have this as well. So people are going to get one main episode and two website-exclusive bonus episodes. So
Lucky people. Well, we better make this a good one, dude. Go out with a bang rather than a whimper, seeing as this is our big, big finale. I'm expecting a round of applause at the end of this, at least for a couple of minutes, 2 to 3 minutes.
You can expect one of those, like Monty Python hand claps, you know, a shot of the ladies, like...
That'll do for me. Yeah.
Okay. Let's get into it. The movie, and we're going with on-screen title here. It might have been known as The Chinese Widow in other territories, but this was the US DVD, and on-screen we have In Harm's Way from 2017. And plot from the Shout Factory website, they're the persons who put out the DVD and Blu-ray in America. The 1941 Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor destroyed American morale. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, risking it all, decided to bomb Japan, bolstering the hopes of the US public for a quick end to the war. However, the pilots, having completed their various missions and facing a fuel shortage going home, had to abandon their warcrafts near their aircrafts near Xinjiang, China. A young pilot, Jack Turner, played by Emil Hirsch, is saved by a young widow named Ying, played by Liu Yifei, or Crystal Liu, as her English name is, who risks her life and hides the injured American in her home. Despite their language barrier, the couple falls in love while she does everything in her power to protect him. So yeah, we have some background here, because I like context, and I mentioned Bille August, the Danish filmmaker who did this. It's generally an international brew of talent on display here. And we start with Danish director Bille August. Born in 1948, and he directed his first film in 1978. So we got a multi-decade working director here who is still making films. Latest was released in 2018, Lykke Per, aka A Fortunate Man, that he made in his native country, Denmark. He is best known for his 1987 film, Pelle the Conqueror, starring Max von Sydow, which ended up winning prestigious awards, such as the Palme d'Or at Cannes and the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. Bille was educated at the Foto- och Dokumentärskolan in Stockholm, Sweden, and began his career as a cinematographer before director, and his eventual debut in My Life actually won awards already there. The debut, it won the Bodil Award for Best Danish Film, so he was often running early in his career. He has branched out internationally before, not just this Chinese film. He made the German-Danish-Swedish co-production Smilla's Sense of Snow that starred Julia Ormond, Gabriel Byrne, and Richard Harris. And In Harm's Way, or The Chinese Widow, was you'd think that must be his first sort of Asian venture. No, it wasn't his first step onto the Chinese market. In 2011, he opened a studio in Hangzhou, China, with the aim to produce Chinese films for the company Changpeng Media that was established a year before. That company gave us at least two films, including The Woman, Night of Mirror Lake, made in 2011 and directed by Herman Yao. Bill jumped back and forward, seemingly. He didn't stay in China for a number of years in a row or anything. He directed Night Train to Lisbon in 2013, starring Jeremy Irons. The Passion of Marie and Silent Heart back in Denmark, and then The Chinese Widow, a.k.a. In Harm's Way, in 2017. And it was released in China that year, and the US and France the year after. It was nominated for Best Film at the Golden Goblet Award, which is the competition at the Shanghai International Film Festival. But it didn't win, and it failed to make a dent in China. It ranked number 142 on that year's box office list. That's Chinese and international films combined, granted, but still pretty low. And
I mean, that's out of 2,000 films, right? So I think it's pretty good.
it's a movie-making climate, China, that's for sure. And international films still play well. But it had a gross of about 4.5 million US. And it peaked at number 7 on its opening weekend. So not a particularly great performer. That's Bill August's career in a nutshell. Liu Yifei. So she's best known now, I suppose, not back then. As the star of Disney's live-action version of Mulan, released in 2020. I have no relationship with even the animated one. I've never seen it. So I never had any interest in a live-action one, despite the big cast of our action favorites. But did you pursue Mulan, at the animated or the live-action?
The animated is one of my favorite Disney films, yeah. So in the cinema as a kid. Really underrated, I think. Came at a bit of a strange time. For Disney post Renaissance, but I really dig it. I'm surprised at how much of a fan base there is for the remake, how much people are kind of clambering for it, but I've not seen it as of yet. But I didn't even make the connection that it was the same actress until reading your script, Ken.
that proves he's reading. Yeah, well, it proves that you're reading these things that are right for us. She's a 33-year-old actress. She's been around for a while. Mulan, or this one, wasn't her first steps into the movie industry. She and her mother emigrated to the United States in 1997, where she attended middle school. She returned to China in 2002 to pursue an acting career under the name Liu Yifei. She's born as An Feng. So it's a stage name. At this point, going back to China, she was accepted into the Performance Institute of the Beijing Film Academy, and she graduated in 2006. She was working, though. She was working professionally as early as 2003 in TV series in China, such as The Story of a Noble Family, which was a ratings and critical success. She performed in a Louis Cha Wuxia novel adaptation, one of many, called Demigods and Semi-Devils, and the TV drama Chinese Paladin, based on a role-playing game that further solidified her popularity in China. So she got to be front and center to some degree across her various TV series. She transitioned to films, and Mulan wasn't her first Hollywood production. And I didn't make this connection until researching this. But she was in the Jackie Chan and Jet Li film, The Forbidden Kingdom, playing Golden Sparrow. I didn't actively dislike that film, but I've only seen it once, and not all aspects stayed with me.
Yeah, not particularly memorable for such a combination of heavy hitters, but it was okay, if I'm remembering right.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of cute that they referenced old-timey cinema, of course. There was a good fight scene between the two, but it was not something like, wow, they got this combo right. It was a one-time watch for me, and that's it was decent enough. But
I think you're right, Ken.
She was in the remake of A Chinese Ghost Story that saw her tackle the iconic role Joey Wong played, and here she acted alongside Louis Koo. Louis Koo isn't the love interest, he's the demon hunter in that one. So he's in the Wu Ma role, but I don't have the name of her love interest in the remake of A Chinese Ghost Story that, if I'm not mistaken, Wilson Yip directed.
Yeah, that's big boots to fill. I have not seen it, so I cannot comment on that, but yeah, that must have been difficult.
Difficult in many ways because of that, but it's a mainland movie, and whether it's a new adaptation from the short story or a full-on remake, I'll leave up to others who have seen it to inform us of. But being a mainland Chinese film, it would come with restrictions in the supernatural.
No sexiness allowed.
No, but it's a supernatural stuff. You can't do it. You have to tweak ghosts and demons and all that thing. So it could be interesting to view it to see sort of like, yeah, this is where they needed to do something different because it's China. But regardless, that's out there. She acted with Chia Yun-fat in the historical drama The Assassins in 2012 and apparently sung the theme song with the man. So that's something to look up. And she has also released a couple of albums as early as 2006. Going back to Mulan, it was announced in 2017 that she was going to star in Mulan, but that came to the screens and streaming in 2020 to mixed reviews. So I think they had a gala opening just before the pandemic hit. So it's still, obviously, it took a few years from the announcements to get to the expected release, and then it was pulled and eventually went to streaming and maybe some selected theaters, who knows, but it did, as a matter of fact. So that's sort of up to date in a way, but she returned to TV amidst all of this in 2017 in The Love of Hypnosis, after obviously being away to make big films. She went to the small screen again. She has run into some controversy, and you know, it's not easy to be a public figure, and media information moves so fast, so you need to be smart in navigating these waters, and she has run headfirst into controversy a couple of times in her career. And I have to quote most of this from the wiki because I can't really wrap my head around most of it, to be honest, and that's very, very honest, an honest sort of admission that I'm very stupid, but so I'll have to read this, and you'll probably get this immediately, you, Tom, and listeners. So anyway,
I doubt it.
Quote, in August 2019, Liu reshared an image posted by Chinese newspaper People's Daily, an official newspaper of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party. The image included a quote from Chinese reporter Fu Guohao, who worked for People's Daily's owned tabloid Global Times and was subsequently that Chinese reporter assaulted by protesters after stating during the 2019-2020 Hong Kong protests, "I support Hong Kong police." So that's the image she shared. Oh, he also said, "You can beat me now. What a shame for Hong Kong." So sharing that sparked international controversy, with Liu Yifei being accused of supporting police brutality. Following this, the hashtag Boycott Mulan started trending, supporting a boycott of the movie, so it was around that time as well. In response to controversy, Liu was not present at the 2019 D23 Expo, which gave fans an exclusive sneak peek of her movie, Mulan. And when asked about the controversy in February the year after, in 2020, she stated, "I think it's just a very sensitive situation."
Yeah.
And during an interview with Variety magazine at the time of Mulan's premiere on March 10th, 2020, and again, that I remember images, so like that's Jet Li and Gong Li and everyone's there, but it was just the gala premiere and everything got pulled really quickly there around March 2020. So a couple of movies were on the brink of releasing. You have A Quiet Place 2 and things like that. And they did promotion, but like a day after, everything's gone. Everything needs to be pulled. So it was around that time Mulan was hoping to be released, but in the end didn't. Anyway, around that time she did an interview and she described herself as Asian instead of Chinese, which caused anger among some Chinese social media netizens who threatened to boycott the movie and accused her of forgetting her roots, as well as questioning why a non-Chinese national was playing the legendary Chinese icon. Again, she had lived in America for quite a while. I'll readily admit that I really don't have any comment on that other than that happened, because these are topics I'm not smart enough to discuss, to be honest.
It seems a bit like, you know, six of one, half a dozen of the other, I suppose. Doesn't seem like a very clear...
A storm caused by netizens, however irrational or rational it might be, is still a storm, and that affects everything when there's noise, and whether it was right or not, it can't be ignored. That's the power of social media and hashtags and things like that.
Definitely. Yeah. These things definitely shouldn't be looked at in a kind of black and white way, I would think, and it seems like it has been in this case in terms of the kind of public ostracization of her character, maybe. Seems a bit of a shame, but that's what you get being a star in this day and age with social media, in that you put your opinions out there and somebody's going to have a problem with it and somebody's going to take it to heart and somebody's going to demand your head on a silver platter.
If not the party, then people are going to stir up noise, you know. I mean, we're not looking at as far as I know, a band like with Tang Wei after Last Caution. We talked of Tang Wei during the Tale of Four Cities.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she got a media ban and took a few years before she could appear in stuff again. She can now, and she's doing well for herself, but that couldn't have been easy to just receive a, you know, go on a blacklist in China.
No, not at all. But yeah, it's got to be tough these days to be in the public, in the limelight.
That's why I would never do a video podcast like you guys do, like not even on this small scale level. Like, you're not getting anything.
Yeah, we've had our fair share of ostracization. Keep it coming, guys. Keep it coming. It just makes us stronger and better.
You're more brave because you're lubricated a little bit going into the video podcasting, because you do a beer podcast.
It's true. You have to be when it comes to our show.
Okay, let's move on to the Bille August film here. Danish filmmaker, sort of the debut of a Danish filmmaker on the podcast on Fire Network, surely. In harm's way, perfectly enjoyable, accessible story. It does not position itself as a big war epic, but because it's only 97 minutes, and spends most of its time producing small-scale drama with fair tension and emotions. I have my problems with it going as far as it does romantically. I'll get to that in my notes. But generally, I think director Bille August shows a restraint, an investment in the material about people connecting despite disconnection in culture and language. So it's perfectly fine. I have some issues. So in short, what did you think?
Yeah, I think I agree with your summation of that there, Ken, to be honest. I think I was expecting more of a romantic film, kind of looking at the plot and the poster, thinking that it was going to be a bit more focused on that, but it's a bit more kind of low-key. I like the fact that, yeah, you said there's a war going on, but it's more kind of playing in the pocket somewhere of this small town, and it is more of a human drama rather than a big scale war epic. I dug it. I really did. I had a few problems with the ending, but I think for the majority of the runtime, I really enjoyed it.
So we hinted at that it's a short 97 minutes, so it's not grand all the time. It doesn't desperately need to bump it to 2 hours, which is good. It's a flashback structure, so we see Emil Hirsch at the beginning of the movie getting a debriefing, and needs to debrief his superiors after his crash and how he's fled from the Chinese village and all of that. So we know something has gone on. So there's less politics here, Tom. There's less intricacies of war, and it's a more small heart-to-heart story on the ground rather than from the air. I mean, those sequences are dealt with and they're fine, but with Emil Hirsch and crew doing selective bombing over Tokyo. But I don't think this movie should have relied on its destruction, because it's kind of middle-of-the-road CG bombing scenes. It looks a little bit fussy, you know. it isn't the grand CG statement of the mainland Chinese film industry. It's doable, but it should be over fast, because the more you focus on that the fires and the bombing looks kind of middle of the road and everything's green screened within the plane, you know, it's good that these are only select sequences, you know.
I agree. Yeah, it's not really the focus of the film. It's more kind of the hook, really, of the film rather than the main focus, and kind of is a good little platform for us to start the human drama and the kind of human interaction, rather than the focus on action scenes, which you know, this doesn't really have. It's a little bit at the beginning, a little bit at the end, but yeah, it's more of a kind of personal, more kind of slow paced film.
Because he sort of quickly sets up the details within the village, decent enough exposition, as you know, the Chinese widow is something to take literally, because she is.
Yeah,
she's a young widow, but that could have its explanations, that it's feasible that she would be married young. Child is bullied because she is a widow, and how that emotionally affects them as a family is set up. But there's no signs of this gem of a drama being set up, but it's all very very, very competently set up. And what I also like is that Bill August is a hands-off director, which is not surprising being European and having made films about people. You know, it doesn't need to have a hyperactive style. The old man hasn't gone like crazy just because he has the toys to play with.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's definitely not a stylistic film, or it's not trying to put in kind of any directorial flourishes per se. I think it's, and that might kind of put off some people.
That stuff works for me because a good story is a good story. You don't need to be fancy about it.
Just let the actors do their thing and let the story speak for itself, which I think really works for this particular film.
There were a couple of times when I normally don't pay attention to this, where I thought there were some cracks in the story. Like there's a scene where the Americans are supposed to land at this Chinese airstrip, and they're awaiting them, and they're saying that they're going to come at dawn, but they come early. And the people that are patrolling the airstrip, they so automatically assume like, oh no, that's a Japanese bomber. Close it, turn off the lights. And I thought that was like, come on, like double check, do some reconnaissance and try and look if it looked like an American plane or a Japanese plane rather than like shut it off.
I think they're a bit short staffed, to be honest, Ken, to,
we're only two of them.
To worry about any of that stuff.
Granted, it was raining, but it was one of those things like, come on, you're supposed to be a military unit and it's a Chinese film, so why aren't you making it yourself smarter?
They looked the worst, didn't they? You know, the Japanese had it going on, to be honest. They were in control. But yeah, I agree. I think it was more to create a little bit of drama in the beginning, wasn't it? A little bit of tension. And yeah, I was surprised at how tense and unnerving it was at times. It's something I wasn't expecting, really. I was expecting little flashes here and there, but it more to be, as I was saying, more of kind of an emphasis on the romance. But it had some really good little dramatic kind of suspenseful moments, which was really cool.
Sure. I mean, when they also get over a little hurdle that they do it in exposition, as the Japanese say that they've spotted a plane. They've seen a plane downed, but we don't see that beforehand either, if the Japanese are spotting them from the ground or if they saw them on radar or whatever. So it was a little like, how did the Japanese spot them? Or maybe they landed straight in their camp, who knows? But it was a little shaky, but then you're right. It got into a more tense situation, and you, despite having, you know, this bloodthirsty Japanese troop leader, as this is a trope and it's a Chinese film,
yeah,
you're right, it leads to some good tension and even some surprising losses here at the beginning of the movie, because you'd think the character of Kai, which is the village headsman and a young character who you'd think could be paired up with Liu Yufei, he dies, he gets shot in the head, and it's not pretty. Good of Bill August to being able to sort of do the unexpected, I suppose.
Yeah, it's not as dreary as I was expecting either. I mean, you think kind of a war-torn part of China might be a bit more. I think it's got that like washed out kind of bleached look to the cinematography. It seems to be the modern kind of go-to stereotypical look of films set in this era, in particular war films. But that's fine. I suppose it works in capturing the bleakness of the time, but it does seem a bit overused. It's crazy the influence that Saving Private Ryan, or at least the look of it, still has on films. But
you know, with Saving Private Ryan, it was really done for a very specific purpose. It's supposed to feel a certain way.
Yeah,
that doesn't mean Steven Spielberg's films are gonna be that way, but that's what genre filmmakers took like and ran with.
Yeah,
you know, despite not making sense, you know.
No, they really did, but I don't think that's you know, points against it. I don't think it ever really gets bogged down in kind of dreariness, and it could do.
I mean, the village life is very daily. Despite you know, they're living
slice of life kind of vibe to it, which I liked.
But they know they're living under sort of Japanese rule, occupation. They have to pass them when they walk in the countryside. And the movie doesn't go down these routes hugely. But, you know, war atrocities happened left and right, courtesy of the Japanese during the Second World War. You know, human experimentation and surely other heinous crimes as well. But the movie doesn't go down those routes more than one scene, I suppose, which is...
No, by the Japanese captain, Sugigoshi Hirotaka, I think, was the fella's name, playing Shimamoto. He's really good, like, he's a real piece of shit.
You know, despite that very tropey role, he has the bloodthirsty, uber-evil Japanese army leader, troop leader. I agree, he was menacing. He was. He generally was.
He was really good, and I think his comeuppance was really satisfying. And I think the scene was played really well, shot really well, and acted really well too.
It's very economical. It's a minimal movie. It's more compelling than a massive outing as well. And therefore, Bill August can execute those sort of thriller moves, I suppose, because there is. One or two sequences where Emil Hirsch's character is hiding under the floorboards, and you have the Japanese actor Tsukagoshi Hirotaka walking above. I mean, it's not Inglourious Basterds tense, but it's all fine. Those scenes certainly had you on the edge, and then Bill, of course, has to deal with. And I looked forward to this, how they were going to solve the lack of communication and connect, because there is a crutch here. It's not like, oh, I studied English when I was little, so I can talk to you, Jack Turner.
No.
So it's not that. So it's kind of cute. So some things could be understood because they know what situation they're in the whole scheme of things with war going on. Some things can be drawn and understood, and... you know, as Jack Turner draws four or five other figures on a paper, she understood that he didn't crash alone, obviously. So she understands that he's probably thinking of his crew. That's good. Those are good little beats. That's how they enhance their communication. That's how they stay nonverbal. That's, I think, is a sign of a veteran director, you know, not dumping exposition on us or a massive amount of dialogue, because he has set up a non-verbal environment. They can't really speak. And I think he gets away with that decently, especially as they connect. You know, he walks around her environment, seeing obviously a picture of her husband, but it's a very small bit. I don't think Bille stops and he, like, I have a 10-second shot of Emil Hirsch's character holding up the picture.
No, it's very subtle. Yeah, it's
you sort of
subtle.
See him just walking around in like this master shot almost, and that's a good beat. So, and he doesn't try to be forceful either as a character in his condition or as a person. Just because I'm American, I gotta do what I like here and say what I like and get some food. Damn it! No, he's injured, and his instinct is not to force his hand and or anything. He knows that he needs to get out and get to Chongqing. In this case,
yeah.
But he needs help. He can't get out of there alone or anything. So yeah.
Yeah, I really agree. And it's not. You think that it might be a bit boring or turn out to be a bit boring because they can't communicate. But I think it's interesting seeing the way that the relationship between all three of them, Jack, Ying, and the daughter Nunu, the way that the relationship develops and it does so very organically, and it's smart with the way it handles the communication, as you were touching upon, Ken, like with the pictures and then the whistling and then just like hand gestures, and I think it's really good. It works really well. It's definitely done with some thought to it, rather than, as you say, kind of be a bit lazy. And you know, we end up getting the fella at the end who does speak English, but he doesn't come in too quickly, and it's not, the situations are not sorted that quickly. It's kind of, it's left to stew and left to kind of, we're left, you know, to enjoy the time with the characters and watching their relationship build.
Yeah, that character, and I won't spoil it because there might be people who want to pursue this movie. That character,
other than us,
and have maybe in the past, even before us. But that character, and I won't tell listeners who it is, you don't know if he's going to be a little bit of a bastard or
yeah.
not.
No, it's good. It's good.
And I like that was kept in the dark until we got the full reveal of what he is and how he is as a person. The kid is lovely, by the way. She's honest about the danger that having Jack there means, but she also comments that he eats like a pig. He eats with his fingers, and I thought that was very funny.
She's really good. I think she doesn't get... or the director doesn't let her get bogged down in the usual hysterics and sobbing that children or child actors get left with. You know what I mean? The filmmakers give her something to do. She gets some good lines. She gets some good interaction. And weirdly, in the credits, there's like two actresses listed for her. There's a young Nunu and an old Nunu. But
well, here's the thing. I read this after I wrote the script. They filmed a scene with actress Vivian Wu as older Nunu, but because they have a little thing at the end that where we fast forward in time, but that was cut ultimately. But they honored sort of her participation by keeping her as in the credits as a special acknowledgement, special thanks, which is more than I expected, because when people are cut, then we don't need to put them in the credits. Hurrah. We paid her, but we don't need to put her in the credits because she's not in it. Fuck you. But no, they did an honorable thing of keeping her, I suppose. So yeah, they didn't have twin little actors for this role.
That's interesting to know that. Yeah, they're saving so much money by losing that one credit, aren't they? So I don't know why they didn't go with that. Do you know what I mean? Must have saved millions. Typing that whole name out as so-and-so. Ridiculous. Fair play to keeping it in.
What I had a problem with, actually, I mean, it's all fine, but when Billy August is pulling the trigger on the romantic connection, I like how it builds up to a connection without language, because she's a widow, just a certain amount of longing, this is a man, and but I, in all honesty, it's a minor spoiler, but you know they're kissing on the posters, and you know they're going to kiss at some point. I found myself having trouble that it making sense that it would develop into a full romantic connection based on no language. I would have loved for the kissing scene to be more like, and it's going to sound off, but I'm going to say it anyway, to be more like a hugging scene. And a big old hard hug, you know, emotional hug or whatever.
Hearty hug.
I wasn't fully on board with this being a romantic connection sense in this short time and sense language. But I wasn't bored with them meaning something to each other, because she has protected him and she has protected her in a pivotal scene that's where we're not going to discuss, a pivotal violent scene. And that's where I sort of thought four steps was good, the fifth step not needed. But I didn't like check out of the movie. I started, you know, fuming or anything. But it was like, I know it's a romantic film, but god damn it, I would have liked for it to be a connection, but not a romantic connection, you know.
Yeah, you don't think they deserve that conclusion with the way that the film had progressed?
I think the conclusion is fine. That it could have still been emotional. That, you know, because, you know, it's hard to talk about. Other than I think it went a bit too far based on the small amount of time they spent with each other. But that's an entirely personal thing, yeah, of course.
No, I see that. Like, it does seem to be that there'd be a bit more growth in between those kind of two stages of just getting to know each other and then kissing. I suppose, yeah, I can see what we did. It was kind of like this gradual build up, and then it kind of tend to, well, it seemed to rush during the back few minutes, maybe. But I think they probably needed that to maybe give the ending, or at least the kind of last few scenes, a bit more of an emotional punch, possibly. Sure. I can see why they did it, but yeah, I liked it. But I can also see your point of view as well, Ken, that it maybe escalated a bit too quickly towards the back end.
And if this would have been a project Mabel was involved in, I would have liked to believe that a toned down romance and sensitivity, which we do get overall, could have come from Mabel as a co-writer. You know what I mean? So it's not out of the realms of possibility that it is a project I think she could have found a home in as a co-writer. So without spoiling it, I think Bill August gets to us with some loss towards the end. We were kind of set up and fooled at the start. I won't say anything else about that, but I thought those beats were effective. I was kind of like, oh no, and had a little bit of a cry. So like, he got to me.
I think I just wanted it to be a bit more, I don't know, just have a little bit more something there. I just think with the way it ended, I don't know. I think I just wish for a bit more, to be honest. But I think it worked. It wasn't a bad ending by any means. It definitely worked. But just a little bit more would have been nice.
And in terms of chemistry, it's fine. I think she's believable enough as a young mother. He's believable enough as a captain. Their chemistry is okay, but they're not. I don't think it's an enduring two-hander necessarily. He's not the most charismatic fella out there necessarily, but it's all functional for the story. Looking at his credits, I wanted to see, like, have I seen anything he's in? And at least one film I saw, which I quite liked, the Autopsy of Jane Doe. Him and Brian Cox, which is a good little two-hander of a horror movie where their corpse is brought into their for them to perform an autopsy on, and then horror kicks off.
Yeah, I think I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it. But that sounds like a good combo.
And because I'm a big fan of Brian Cox, so it's not like he's always good automatically. He somehow is, but it's a good little horror film.
Yeah, definitely. I think the only film I'd seen him in is Killer Joe, William Friedkin's hitman film with Matthew McConaughey. I think I remember him being really good in that, or at least very effective in that. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but yeah, that's the only experience I'd had with Emil Hirsch earlier or prior to this film.
He's got a little bit of Stephen Dorff vibe
definitely.
And I'm a fan of Stephen Dorff as well, but it's all functional chemistry. So any particular comment you want to leave? I mean, you invested in the story, so clearly they weren't bad performances per se.
No, I think they were just good, very good, like very subtle, were well with what they were given, with the material they were given. No kind of great shakes in terms of acting or any, you know, Oscar-worthy performances, you know, nothing like that. It didn't seem like a really huge push on the acting. It was just subtle. It worked. Well done. And sometimes, you know, when you're working on a smaller film, I think it helps it a little bit. I think it could probably get a bit lost in the shuffle if you had these big, huge screen presences with these, you know, massive monologues and stuff like that. I think it just works really well within the context of the film and helps the film rather than kind of gets in the way of it. But so many, I just look in so many different titles for this film.
Yeah, The Hidden Soldier was apparently a French title where they use that in English in France, for instance. But
The Hidden Soldier, The Lost Soldier, Destiny in the War, which it looks like to me like maybe a Japanese title. I was reading earlier, funny enough as well, there's a John Wayne movie from the 60s called In Harm's Way, which concentrates on an admiral who gets a second chance to prove himself against the Japanese after Pearl Harbor.
Right.
Which is interesting. It was apparently based on a novel. So interesting that they took that title, because it seems to be like it shares a few narrative kind of connections.
Sure. I mean, it says based on true events on a DVD cover. And I think it references the fact that examples of this did happen, where downed American soldiers got cared for by the Chinese and smuggled out by guerrillas and so forth. But it doesn't mean that this particular event happened between these people, and they were called this in real life, Jack Turner and Ying. That's how they rationalized that. We won't spoil it, but I guess the very final ending, it's a Chinese film, so it needs to ultimately play in favor of the Chinese people, that the Chinese people did good. So it's there's a little coda that I think it rings a little bit of imposed on the production. And Billy August, you might have won an Oscar for your film, but it's a Chinese film, so you need to do this. And it's fine. But in reality, if this movie wasn't made in an environment that required certain things of you, you didn't need to have the modern day coda necessarily.
No, I didn't feel like there was kind of any hindrance there, you know, from it being a Chinese co-production, and it wasn't too on the nose. I feel like that last title card, it just kind of connected with the overall, you know, realism of the film, or the fact that obviously it was...
Well, I have no problem with the title card, but I would have rather had the movie end on Emil Hirsch going through those doors, right? And then, boom, you can have that title card, but... some small issues, but I was invested, and it was kind of cool to see a veteran director like Bill August do okay, adequately, and in this market, and even got to me emotionally during points. So I was satisfied and happy we took this detour connected to Mabel Chung that turned out not to be connected to Mabel Chung, but we gained a new experience out of it. So hurrah.
Yeah, well, it's not, we haven't, have we had confirmation? We can't say completely for certain. We don't know, but
I did show screen grabs from the credits just to make sure. There are English credits, of course, but I showed to Kevin Ma to see, like, is Mabel in there, but not in English? But, and it's like, no, she's not. Like, damn it. Well, we have the movie, so.
You didn't put Kevin with this, did you? Jeez. That's dedication. That's dedication.
I had to buy one entire DVD to take a chance on one entire DVD disc.
The lengths we will go to discuss discuss cinema. Yeah, I think I agree. I think it's Billy August's best work since the two episodes of The Adventures of Young Indiana Jones he did as well. So I'm just going to put that out there.
Did it really?
Yeah.
Someone has been reading IMDb.
I love that show as a kid. I haven't seen it since then. I'll be interested to revisit it.
I think we were shown Pele the Conqueror in school, but I mean, I must have been like 8 or 9 years old by that point. So I may remember nothing, but it's Max von Sydow. I'm sure it's excellent all around, but I simply haven't seen it again. Do you have any other comments you want to leave us with?
I don't think so. I think that's me all commented out. How about you?
No, not really. Let's talk of the availability. With a couple of also known as, it's hard to pinpoint exactly where it was released on DVD and Blu-ray, but it seems like there's no UK DVD. So we got hold of the Shout Factory US DVD. They also released the Blu-ray, but at the time I was looking on the regular places, there was no like obvious listing for the Blu-ray, but they did a Blu-ray too. But we did get the DVD. There's also a Swedish DVD, but it only has local subtitles. So obviously being a Mandarin language and English language film, you would need subtitles you could read, Thomas. And the US DVD does the good thing of offering up like subtitles for the entire movie or subtitles just for the Chinese dialogue in case you want to view it like that. So I always like those touches. It's kind of above and beyond because normally you get your English subtitles all the way through. But if you just want to listen to the English and read the Chinese, you can too. So
yeah, it's I forgot to mention, it is on Amazon Prime over here in the UK, which is not something that I recently found out about until about 2 hours ago. But it's under a different name. It's under The Hidden Soldier.
Oh, even in the UK, so it wasn't purely a French title. Okay,
so no DVD, as Ken mentioned. But yeah, it is available on stream if you do want to check it out.
I would guess The Chinese Widow would have been the title that would have gone the furthest, like the title that most would have used. Right, but in harm's way for the US DVD, and it's a little bit hard to, maybe that's why I missed the Blu-ray, maybe that's why I missed, I think I searched on US Prime, and it didn't turn up there, but I might have used the wrong title again.
Yeah, that's, I think because we both looked for it for a bit, and I had a lot of trouble finding it. Until today, I kind of had a little look around.
Do you remember offhand it was streaming on Prime, or it's a rent or buy
it's
thing?
It's streaming. Yeah, it's streaming, okay. On Amazon Prime. You can go and watch it right now, but not until you've listened to this episode. I mean, don't finish the episode here and go and watch it. You know, finish this episode first. Or come back to it. It's your choice.
Streaming in the UK, Amazon Prime, so it's easy, as it turns out, to get a hold of it in the UK. In the UK.
Apparently. But I love the journey, in terms of getting here, Ken. It's all about the journey, not the destination, so let's put that out there.
I have no regrets. It would have been worse if it was a complete dud that was 2.5 hours, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
But it wasn't, and it was way shorter than that, so yeah, indeed.
Breezy. And very enjoyable. Glad we sort it out.
And sorted it out eventually. Is Mabel on it? Is Mabel not on it? All? Who knows?
It doesn't matter.
We don't have her phone number either, so we can't ask. But, you know, if she would have been on the movie as a writer, it would have been the first movie that she did not work on with Alex.
Yeah, it would be her first solo movie, wouldn't it?
Like, I'm doing something on my own. We're getting a divorce.
Interesting. Yeah. This is her first film as a single woman, and I dug it.
So yeah, thank you everybody for following us to the bonus episode section here on the website only. It's a way for us to drive some people to the website. That's why we don't put this up in the feed, and I realize that means we don't have a ton of listeners here in the bonus episode section, but I enjoy producing them for that reason and putting out this on the website only. So thanks for following us all the way. If you listen to A Tale of Three Cities, even the Moon Warriors episode, and here during our discussion in Harm's Way, we were happy to have you. And I think that's us. So let's sign off. And Abin Kennedy with me was Tom KW. So say goodbye to the kind kids who listen to us.
Cheers, kind kids. Really appreciate you taking the time out. Thank you.